Today on Maine Calling, gardens that attract wildlife and help the planet. Many of us love the idea of creating a home landscape that fosters biodiversity, but we don't really want a wild and overgrown looking yard. Ecologist Doug Tallamy says, you don't have to make that choice. You can create a beautiful landscape, even one with a lawn and traditional garden beds, and still make a big difference for wildlife. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we learn what he means. Tallamy is a leading voice in the world of horticulture. His groundbreaking book, Bringing Nature Home, sparked a new way of looking at home gardening. Gardening for beauty, yes, but also for biodiversity and human health. On this Earth Day, Doug Tallamy, ecological horticulture and a healthier planet. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Verrill, committed to delivering trusted legal services in Maine and throughout the Northeast for 163 years. Learn more at verrill-law.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It is Earth Day. And guess what? We can all help planet Earth right in our own backyards. Today, we'll learn about ecological horticulture, how your garden can help wildlife and help the planet. Joining me for the hour, Douglas Tallamy, who is a professor of entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware. He is the author of several best-selling books, including the influential book, Bringing Nature Home. He's also co-founder of Homegrown National Park, which aims to increase biodiversity. We want you to join the conversation. Do you not know where to begin to make your yard or garden more sustainable? Wondering if something you're already doing is helpful or not helpful? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Doug Tallamy, welcome to Maine Calling.
Well, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So, Doug, what you've been saying for years is that everyone's garden, no matter how small, can help wildlife, human health, and even help fight climate change. How is that? How would you like all of us to think about our yard and our landscape?
Right. Well, I like the word landscape as opposed to garden. People tend to think of a garden as a little space in your landscape where you have a few flowers, but I'm talking about the entirety of your property. It can help in a number of ways. There's four things that each property, four ecological responsibilities each property has. One is to support pollinators. One is to sequester carbon, help climate change. One is to manage the watershed in which it lies. And the other is to support a viable food web so you have some animal life running the ecosystem we all depend on. Lawn does none of those things, which is why I'm always picking on it. But there's something we can do to help each one of those goals. Everybody can do something in their yard, even if you simply have a container, or you put a flowering plant in the container, or if you have 10 acres that you can play with. But it's very easy to contribute to those four goals.
It's funny you said you pick on lawns, but you have a lawn at your own home. You pick on them, but you also don't recommend people just let it all go if they don't want to.
Yeah, turf grass is the perfect plant to walk on. So wherever you actually walk in your yard, that's an appropriate place for it. It is, we call it a cue for care. We do, you know, lawn is a status symbol, and it's a very important one in our current culture. So we're not trying to rebel against everything, but we've got 44 million acres of lawn in this country. That's an area bigger than all of New England. And lawn itself is an ecological deadscape. So what we talk about is reducing the area of lawn, not getting rid of it entirely, using it in smaller spaces to show that we understand what the culture is. It really helps neaten things up. You don't have to put anything on it. You don't need the fertilizer and the pesticides, but mowing it is important to help fit in.
Yeah, you know, I think that a lot of people think if I want to start planting native plants, if I want to do things to attract wildlife, it has to look like a mess out there. But your gardens and the gardens that you have highlighted in your books are quite beautiful and really don't look that different than the kind of gardens people have planted for decades.
Right. Most people don't know the difference between a native plant and a non-native plant, but they do know what neat is. They know what maintenance is. Formality is a function of the design. It's not a function of the plants that are in the design. One thing to keep in mind is that our native plants are used in formal designs in Europe every day. They love them over there. So if Europeans can love our native plants, maybe we can too.
Every time we do a gardening show, Doug, people want to know what to plant for pollinators, you know? But you're saying that this is really about not just planting milkweed and bee balm, though those are wonderful plants, but going beyond that, thinking holistically about your yard. Somebody's listening right now. It's April. They're thinking about what they might be doing in their yard in May. What are some questions you would like people to ask themselves and how to answer those questions?
Well, let's say you really do want to reduce the area of lawn that you have. How might you go about that? The easiest thing to do is to add a tree, add two or three trees to your yard and put a bed under those trees. Immediately, you've added important plants to your yard, particularly if they're woody plants that are going to support the food web. But you've also reduced the area that's in lawn. And planting a tree is easy, particularly if it's small. I'm not saying go out and get a $3,000 15-foot oak tree, but an acorn is free. All you have to do is protect it from the deer. And you'd be surprised how fast those things grow.
Yeah. And you mentioned all the different the four elements that you want to think about. When you say watershed, are you talking about planting a landscape that you don't need to water? Or what you're talking about is thinking about the watershed that your the runoff from your yard will go into?
Yeah, it's more about the runoff. Yes, we do want to create landscapes we don't have to water, because that's an artificial input. And in most places in the country, we don't have the water to dedicate for that. So if you find yourself planting plants that need to be watered constantly, they're probably not the right plants for where you live. But when I talk about watershed, I'm talking about the water table that's beneath your property. I'm talking about keeping the water that falls on the rain that falls on your land, on your property, having it infiltrate instead of running off as stormwater runoff. And lawn is not very good at doing that. It has very short root systems, and there's a lot of runoff when you have a heavy rain. But most other plants with deeper roots are very good at encouraging infiltration. The other part about lawn that ruins watersheds is all that stuff we put on it. We always put too much fertilizer on. Most people are putting fertilizer that has herbicides in it, has insecticides in it, and they don't even know it. And when that runs off, it runs off into our watershed. So keeping water on property and keeping the chemicals out of the watershed is what I mean by managing the watershed.
Your book, Bringing Nature Home, has been very influential in that it sort of started people thinking about this whole thing, our own small pieces of land, a little bit differently. If somebody wants to start thinking differently, wants to start making changes, how quickly can they expect to see a difference? How quickly can they expect to see butterflies and hummingbirds in their yard? How quickly can they expect to see maybe some snakes or just have a different feeling?
Very quickly. That is one of the things that I've been surprised at doing this on our own property in Oxford, Pennsylvania. We had never done it before. The property had been mowed for hay before we moved in, so there were very few plants here. Right away, we started putting in plants, but we put them in. When I talk about planting acorns, that's really what I did. Those trees are now over 60 feet tall, and it's only been, what, 23 years. But I have a picture of an oak tree that is about 3 inches tall, and there's a caterpillar standing on the ground eating the leaves of that tree. So immediately it started to add energy to the local food web. And I'll bet 20 minutes after I walked away with my camera, an oven bird came and ate that caterpillar. So it was a viable part of the local landscape, and it had just popped its head above the leaves. I have a picture of another oak tree that was maybe 3 feet tall. Right in where the first branches separated, there was a nest of a field sparrow. So nature comes back. It's extremely resilient. That's been the positive part of what we're doing. It's been an awful lot of fun recording the different things using our property every year. And at this point, we've recorded 62 species of birds that have bred on our property. And I've been taking pictures of the caterpillars that I find, the different moth species. And I'm up to 1,339 species of moths that are now making a living on our property just because we put the plants back.
Wow. When you say caterpillars on your baby oak tree, I think a lot of people would be worried about that. They would say, "Oh my goodness, I have this small sapling that I'm nurturing and the caterpillars are already after it." But you didn't have that reaction.
No, I said, gee, this oak tree's doing its job. You know, if I want a chickadee to breed in my yard, and I do want chickadees to breed in my yard, it takes between 6,000 and 9,000 caterpillars to get one nest of chickadees to the point where they leave the nest. That's a lot of caterpillars. And then the parents continue to feed them caterpillars another 21 days after they leave the nest. And that's one bird, one nest. It's a bird that's a third of an ounce. What if I want a population of birds and a whole bunch of species? Imagine the number of caterpillars necessary to get those birds to be able to reproduce. You've got to have the plants that actually support those caterpillars. If you have crepe myrtle or burning bush or privet or many of the other things that we typically landscape with, there aren't any caterpillars on those plants. No caterpillars on your local ginkgo tree. So, what are the birds going to eat? And what happens is they don't breed in your yard. And when everybody landscapes that way, they don't breed anywhere. And it's one of the reasons we've had 3 billion fewer breeding birds in North America than we had just 50 years ago. So you really can make a difference by planting the right plants in your yard.
You mentioned that we can help the planet. We can help with carbon sequestration. I think a lot of people don't have, it's easy for a lot of people to understand how planting certain plants can help bring birds into your yard. But what about actually helping fight climate change? How can one person's yard, one person's landscape help in that?
Well, you know, a third of the carbon that is up in the atmosphere, creating all kinds of problems today, has come from us removing plants on the planet. The rest of it comes from fossil fuels that we're planting or pumping up there, but that's a third of the carbon. If we put the plants back, if we regrew forests in so many of the places we've cut them down, and one of those places is suburbia, where there's very few trees compared to what used to be there, we're going to pull a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere. Those trees are created. Their tissues are made up of carbon, and their roots are pumping carbon into the soil every day. And once it's in the soil, that's long-term storage. It can stay there thousands of years. So plants are an important tool in our fight against climate change. And the more plants you put in your yard, the more you are helping.
I think a lot of people rightly are concerned about ticks here in Maine, as I'm sure they are in Pennsylvania as well. Tell me how you think about that real problem of Lyme disease and ticks. And you're an entomologist, you love caterpillars, you want these most of the beneficial insects to be in our pro on our property.
That's right, but I'll remind you, ticks are not insects. So
That's right. That's
I
right.
have had Lyme disease 5 times. So yes, I
Oh
understand how
dear.
serious it is. That's another important use of lawn. I talked about having swaths of lawn through your yard, and it's going to be mowed lawn. Ticks want to climb up on vegetation. They put out their little legs. It's called questing. And when you walk by and you brush up against tall vegetation, they'll grab on, and that's how they get on you. But they're typically not in a mowed lawn. So having places for you to walk around your yard where you don't have to brush up against vegetation, particularly between May and June, that's the when you have peak infectivity for Lyme disease, that will help a lot. We need to think about the causes of Lyme disease. It's too many deer. You know, when I was growing up, there were very few deer, and there were no deer ticks, and we had no Lyme disease. But now we have overabundance of deer pretty much across the country. Lyme disease has exploded. So addressing the problem at its main cause would be something that we need to think about. That's something the homeowner probably isn't going to do. But if somebody's talking about culling deer, don't fight it. It's we have way too many deer for the health of our local ecosystems and for our own health.
I want to ask you, I think a lot of people have a limited budget. You mentioned that someone can plant an acorn. If someone just wants to spend a little bit of money this year, what's a good place to start?
Oh, good question. There's something called addition by subtraction. So if you say, I'm going to let this part of my yard, maybe you're going to create a small pollinator garden, a meadow, but you don't want to plant anything. All you have to do is stop mowing that part and remove the plants you don't want. We have a serious problem with invasive species. Everybody has it, and they're always coming into the areas that we don't tend. So you remove those plants as they come in, but the native plants come in as well. Leave the native plants, remove the non-natives, and you can actually create a viable meadow without planting a single thing, without spending any money at all. That's one way to do it. You live in Maine, you want to plant what's appropriate for your eco region, and blueberries certainly are appropriate. So I might think about putting in a couple of blueberry bushes. They're a wonderful fall color, and you get to eat those blueberries. But you can do that without spending a whole lot of money. If you say, I'm going to add one plant to my yard every year, it adds up. It really does add up.
What is the ideal balance? I know that this is I'm opening up a can of worms here, that there's a little bit of a debate over this. What do you recommend the goal is? What percentage of your plants ought to be, or native plants to really help the planet?
Yeah, there's a couple points here. First of all native plants are not created equal. Some are much more powerful than others. We call those keystone plants. So you want to when you're adding natives to your yard, you want to focus on those keystone plants because you'll get the biggest impact from them. But there is room for compromise. So we have thought about plants as if they were decorations for the last 100 years because they are beautiful. They are decorations. So it doesn't mean that if you're going to plant native, you can't have any beautiful plants. First of all, there's a lot of beautiful native plants out there. But let's say you really do love your crepe myrtle. You can have your crepe myrtle. It's not contributing anything to your yard except it's a beautiful plant. There's no doubt about it. But I like to think of plants like that as if they were statues. So how many statues do you want in your yard? You can decide that. We did a study that demonstrated you can have, if you have 70% of your woody plant biomass native, you can sustain a viable food web. You can have that breeding chickadee in your yard. But that gives you 30% that you can play with without worrying about how much they're actually contributing. You don't have to worry about how many caterpillars those plants are contributing. Now, if you have 100% native, it's going to contribute more. So it's up to you. This is a, personal decision.
You say 70% biomass. So if you're lucky enough to have a great big old oak tree, that goes a long way, right?
It certainly does. You can have all the hostas you want under that oak, and the oak will take care of it.
We are speaking with Doug Tallamy, ecologist, author of several books about ecological horticulture. The one you likely have heard of is called Bringing Nature Home. What are your questions for him? Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, my guest is ecologist Doug Tallamy. He is known for his books about protecting wildlife habitat and fostering biodiversity in the landscape. Today, we talk with him about this, and pretty soon we'll ask him about this idea of a homegrown national park. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you have questions about your own property? Do you have any success stories to share? Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now is Eric Topper, who is Director of Education at Maine Audubon. Thanks so much for joining us, Eric.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Doug. Hi, Jennifer.
I
Hey.
understand that Doug's work inspired Maine Audubon to also teach people about bringing nature home. Tell us about what you're working on and what people can be involved with.
Yeah, that's true. Back in 2015, some supporters of Maine Audubon brought us Doug's ideas and his book and encouraged us to think about starting some programming around that. And Maine Audubon, which is focused on conserving Maine wildlife and wildlife habitat, we were pretty blown away and pretty inspired by Doug's work. And we decided to start a program called Bringing Nature Home in Maine. And we thought we could sort of hold up those values and those ideals as a statewide organization and get people focused on restoring native plants and those food webs Doug mentioned as that fourth point in his project. And since then, we've hosted many, many events, including a couple featuring Doug Tallamy himself here in Maine. We've also started our own native plant sales, which now happen online. People can start buying plants from us starting May 1st, ordering online and picking them up in person at Gilson Farm in Falmouth or Fields Pond in Holden. We also have our coming up on our ninth anniversary of our Native Plants Festival, Native Plant Sale and Festival at Gilsland Farm on June 7th, and then lots of partnerships and projects all over the state that, again, advance that idea of engaging communities in restoring native plants and native food webs.
Eric, tell us about the growth in your native plant sale. How big was it in the beginning, and how big will it be this year?
Yeah, so the first plant sale we had was a little fledgling fall sale in 2016. I think we almost sold $10,000 worth of plants, as opposed to last year in 2014, we totaled $165,000 in plant sales. And we're selling about somewhere around 6,000 or 7,000 plants a year, mostly via retail, but also have lots of partnerships where we're helping restoration professionals and municipalities and others get the native plants that they need as well. So it's been a huge, huge growth for us. One of our larger projects, and we just couldn't be more excited to have learned the idea and followed Doug's lead.
So if somebody stopped by the plant sale in 26 or 2017 and hasn't been since, you say come back. It's an entirely different thing.
Oh, come back for sure. Lots more programming and activities, lots more species all the species that we sell and promote are historically native to Maine. And we've definitely even done a deeper dive into kind of county nativity for some of our projects. So people are going to find everything they're going to find at a Maine Audubon plant sale is exactly the kind of plant that Doug's espousing and talking about here today.
Well, before I let you go, Eric, I have to ask what the best sellers are. What is everyone looking for?
Everyone loves milkweed, that's for sure. The kind of monarch butterflies are such an iconic species, really for so many people here in Maine, but also those of us who moved here from away. We're familiar with that sort of continental migration of that species and the high-profile decline of that species, and milkweed becomes one of those great plants and great connections to the host plant phenomena that Doug is so expert in and has helped advanced, that's a big seller for us. People love their trees and shrubs as well. There's probably too many to name specifically, but those are some of our big sellers.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Eric Topper, Maine Audubon's Director of Education. Doug Tallamy, I should mention that Maine Calling is going to do a program on May 7th on butterflies. But I wanted to ask you about, you're hearing all about bringing nature home, but that's just one of your big projects. You also have this project I mentioned a minute ago, Homegrown National Park. What is that?
Well, that actually came about, the idea came about years ago when I saw that statistic that we had 40 million acres of lawn. I said, well, gee, what would happen if we cut that area in half? So if everybody cut their lawn in half, that would give us 20 million acres that we could restore right at home. I said, well, how big is 20 million acres? And I started to add up the acreage of our biggest national parks. And you can add them all together, you know, Yosemite and Yellowstone, add them all up. It's still less than 20 million acres. So I said, well, gee, we could it'd be enough to create a new national park. It'll be the biggest national park in the country. We're going to do it at home, so we'll call it Homegrown National Park. So I talked about it. It's a chapter in my Nature's Best Hope book. But it wasn't until I met Michelle Alfandari, who she had just retired from a career in Manhattan, knew nothing about nature, knew nothing about the biodiversity crisis, but she did know about reaching people. And she said, we have to create a nonprofit so that you can get this message out to the millions and millions and millions of people who do not know they are the future of conservation. So that's what Homegrown National Park is about. It is a small nonprofit. Our website's homegrownnationalpark.org. You go there, it's free. You can register your property on the biodiversity map. So your location and then the amount of area that you're pledging to be a good steward of. So maybe you really are going to reduce the area of lawn. Maybe you're going to plant that oak tree. Maybe you're just going to put a flower in a flower pot on your porch. Anything counts. And then your little piece of your county is going to light up with a firefly. And of course, the object is to get the entire country to light up with fireflies. So our mission really is to convince the millions of people that are the future of conservation, that they have a responsibility to do that. That nature, the nature that we have in our parks and preserves is not enough to run the ecosystems that we depend on. And it's up to us to turn that around. So that's our goal. That's our mission. We're not very old, only 3 or 4 years old, and we're small, but we're growing quickly.
We'll go to Dale, who's calling from St. George. Hi, Dale. Go ahead.
Hi, Doug. This is Dale. How are you? You have had a big impact on me. I saw some of your seminars at various industries. And when you were speaking in St. George, you came to my house and helped me change how I structured our business and how I run my house and how often I recommend following your lead. And I can't say enough about you relative to the impact you have and the quality of your programs and information. I want to thank you, and I hope you have a great day.
Well, I appreciate your support.
Dale, thanks so much for calling in. We'll go to Anne, who's calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Anne, go ahead.
Hey there. I want to be a bit of a hostage defender, and let me tell you, I hear hostage disparaged regularly. I do have a lot of hostage, partially because I have a 70 by 30 vegetable garden, and I have lined the entire thing with hosta. It's a great weed barrier when it gets going, gets tight. The other thing is, it blooms late, and the bees love it. So does that mean that, it's somehow inferior as far as a feeder for bees?
Anne, thanks so much. I don't think Doug's going to be mean to you for liking hostas. There's so many millions of people who love hostas. Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, they're particularly useful when they bloom, not just for bees, but for hummingbirds. One of the things I want to focus on, though, when we're making pollinator gardens is we have to think about all the native bees, too, not just the honeybees. People see a lot of bees going to flowers and they say, see, this is great for pollinators. But keep in mind, honeybees are also non-native. They're important for agriculture. But we have somewhere between 3,600 and 4,000 species of native bees. And over a third of them can only reproduce in the pollen of particular native plants. So we can have all the hostas we want, but we want to add those native plants to support the specialist pollinators, bees as well.
Anne, thanks for your question. You know, we keep using the phrase native plants, Doug, and this is a little bit of a tricky one, isn't it? Especially because we know that, for example, Maine used to be covered in a sheet of ice. So what is a native plant? How do you define it?
A native plant is one that has an evolutionary history with the plants and animals around it. So yes, Maine used to be covered with a sheet of ice, but the plants that are in Maine now were pushed south. It didn't happen overnight, so they were pushed south, and many of those plants were pushed all the way down to the Gulf Coast. And when I should talk about plant communities. When the glaciers retreated, those plant communities moved north again. But the plants moved together, the animals that depend on them moved together. So they didn't abandon that evolutionary history. When we bring plants over from Asia or from Europe or South America, our local animals and insects have no evolutionary history with those plants, which means they're typically unable to use them. So I always talk about the monarch as an example of host plant specialization. It is locked into eating milkweeds because it developed a specialized relationship with milkweeds that is millions of years old. And if you take away milkweeds and put those hostas in, for example, the monarch's not going to be able to start to use hostas. It's locked into that plant that it has specialized on. So that's why we want to keep these relationships together so that we keep all the players in our ecosystems. Studies have shown a long time ago that the number of species in an ecosystem determines how productive it is. In other words, how many ecosystem services, how much life support it's providing, and also how stable it is. So we want to keep our ecosystems as species rich as possible. And every time we lose a species from an ecosystem, it becomes less productive and less stable.
Mm. We're talking about native plants. What about plants that are cultivars that are very closely related to native plants but aren't technically native plants?
Well, they are native plants. They're just a genetic variant of a native plant. So we usually, some cultivars have been found in nature. So for example, Acer rubrum October glory, it was a particularly red maple, and somebody brought it in and put a name on it, but nature created it. Other cultivars were selected for by humans. So whether or not that cultivar is as useful ecologically as the straight species depends on the genetic trait that has been enhanced. We did a study looking at six different cultivar traits of woody plants, and the only ones that actually discouraged insect use was taking a green leaf and making it red or purple, because that's loading the leaf with anthocyanins, which are feeding deterrents. And so if you want to support those caterpillars to have the chickadees and other things in your yard, you don't want to use the red cultivars. But all of the other cultivar traits, taking a tall plant and making it short, or introducing disease resistance and so on, didn't affect the insects at all. So most cultivars are focused on flowers. If you take a bloodroot, for example, and create a double flower out of it, that turns the reproductive parts of the flower into petals. Well, then it removes all of the pollen and nectar from that flower. So it's no benefit to any pollinators. So double flowers they're beautiful, but they're not useful to pollinators. So it depends on what the trait is. You don't want to say all cultivars are good or all cultivars are bad. The answer is it depends.
We'll go to Sarah calling from Piscataquis County. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, hello. Hi. So I grew up in the country, but now I live in a small town on a main street, very small lot, very little gardening experience. I do let a lot of my lawn go to meadow because that's what I'm used to. And then I have to try to, you know, cut it down before it gets too, I basically need a sickle to cut it down. But I'm wondering how to cultivate wildflowers, if I should strew it on the lawn, if I should put it in beds. I bought one of those burpee mixes, like a mix of wildflowers, and that's my favorite kind of flower. Just wondering advice on how to get those to grow and where and how in my yard.
I think if you're talking about a front yard, you want it as controlled as possible. Then you'll fit in with the culture without getting people upset. So you can do that with container gardening very easily. And actually, if you go to our website, homegrownnationalpark.org, there's a section on there that tells you the best native plants for containers in all the ecoregions of the country. So that's a useful source. Or you can have very defined beds, and they're defined by that little bit of lawn that you maintain. But it shows that what you're doing is intentional, that you haven't moved out and you've just abandoned your yard. That's the look you don't want to favor.
Sarah, thank you for your call. Let's see. An email here from Roberta. I have an abundance of maple seeds germinating all over my yard and flower beds. I've never had so many. Are they cyclical?
Whether or not plants make seeds does depend in part on the weather. So, for example, the elms that I have in my yard this year is a big year for making elm seed. Last year, they made none. And that's probably because we had it was raining when the pollen was moving around, or we had a frost. Something discouraged the production of seeds that year. Most plants try to make seeds every single year. but sometimes the weather interferes with that. Big exception would be oaks that have what we call a mast year. They usually do not make acorns every year, and they'll wait 2 or 3 years, make a few here, a few there, but then they have this mast year where they're going to make thousands and thousands of acorns. And nobody's been able to really explain or predict when that's going to happen. They explain it by saying, well, when you make so many acorns in 1 year, then the things that eat acorns, and a lot of things eat acorns, there will be enough acorns to survive all of those acorn predators.
Yeah. And we want to know, we're talking about trees right now, but we are doing an Arbor Day show on tree care on that Friday. So I want to go to this email from the Wild Seed Project. This may help answer the question from our audience member just a couple minutes ago. The Wild Seed Project is a local organization that promotes biodiversity and use of native plants in the suburban and urban landscape. Their website, wildseedproject.net. And yes, we've had them on Maine Calling, but this is kind of fun. Emily Baisden, the director, was a grad student of Doug Tallamy at the University of Delaware. So fun connection to you, Doug.
As a matter of fact, Emily did that cultivar study I just talked about.
Oh, really? That's terrific. Well, we are going to take another quick break. Lots of calls and questions coming in. You can give it a try, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling. Our topic today, how your little piece of land can contribute to a healthier planet. That's according to our guest, professor and ecologist Doug Tallamy with the University of Delaware. He has several best-selling books, including Bringing Nature Home. He co-founded Homegrown National Park. Share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Doug, earlier in the program, we were talking about how we help the planet by increasing carbon sequestration when we plant plants. What are some of the other ways?
What I want to do is use a different phrase. The planet is going to be fine, whether we disappear or not, whether we ruin our life support. What we're really helping is us. We're helping humans. When I talk about ecosystems and life support, that is exactly what I mean. We depend entirely on nature. We're products of nature. And if we destroy, the nature that feeds us, the hand that feeds us, we're going to pay for it. And unfortunately, that's what we're doing. We've got parks, we've got preserves, but we're still in the sixth great extinction event the planet has ever experienced, which is why I'm talking about bringing nature home. I'm talking about redesigning our human-dominated landscapes so that we have ecosystem function right where we live. That means you're going to have pollinators, you're going to have birds, you're going to have animals right in suburbia. And that makes the distance between the parks and preserves viable habitat. All of a sudden, it's not no man's land. That's what we have to do to stem this biodiversity crisis that we're talking about. So it's really a selfish act. It's something we have to do for our own good. And that's what I wanted to say about helping the planet. We're helping humans.
We have an email here from Jay. Considering lupins are invasive species existing in Maine for only 150 years, are they harmful or helpful to the ecosystem? It's a tricky one, isn't it, Doug? Because people love the lupins, and there is nothing like driving down a main road when the lupins are in bloom.
Yeah, it is a tricky nuance. So plants that are native to areas in the country that are close by, but we've moved them to our area. They're a little bit out of range. They're invasive if they're pushing native plants from that region out. I don't know enough about the lupins in Maine to comment on that intelligently, but it is something I hear about all the time. I talk about using plants to maintain food webs, and food webs are pretty forgiving. So for example, an insect that eats a beech tree can eat a beech tree from Florida or a beech tree from Canada. It doesn't care about where that beech tree is from. What makes a difference is the genetic makeup of the seed of that beech tree. If I plant a beech tree from Florida in my yard in Pennsylvania, it's gonna get too cold and kill that tree. So this is called plant provenance, and that's just as important when you're talking about what is native and not native to your area. as maintaining the local food web.
An email here from Mindy. A few years ago, I began the slow process of changing my lawn over to clovers, ground covers, and mosses. I'm amazed at the variety of clovers and what they can do, everything from cutting down on the amount of mowing to breaking up compacted soil to stabilizing it. I live on a big hill beside a river, so I don't use herbicides, which adds an additional challenge, especially when trying to stay on top of invasives. It's amazing how resistant people are to change, especially with respect to lawn.
Right. And those clovers are also adding nitrogen to your yard, so you don't have to fertilize your yard. It's another benefit. They're also a very good source of pollen and nectar for your generalist pollinators. When I was growing up, all the lawns had white clover in it. It was just a standard feature of lawns. So the reason we don't now is that the lawn companies, the grass companies, say, no, you have to have pure grass, and they put in a herbicide that makes sure it kills everything except the grass. Not necessary.
So many calls coming in. Let's see, we'll go to Jude calling from South China. Hi, Jude. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Doug. And
hello.
I'm a member of the Homegrown National Parks.
Thank you.
Jude, do you have
a
question?
I wanted to comment. Here in China, we're starting a community garden. And as part of that, we're going to be planting some pollinators. I've been rewilding my little 2 acres here for about 6 years, and Wild Seed Project has been a help, as has the Knox-Lincoln Conservation District sale and Fedco. And I wanted to also say hello to Dale, who talked to you from St. George earlier. So I've been planting all sorts of plants in my swamp, in my woods, and my field, and I just want to say to people, it's so easy to just keep adding natives.
Well, Jude, thank you. I guess Doug would probably agree with that.
I would agree. The most challenging thing about making pollinator gardens is having something blooming the entire season long. So you have to have a sequence of plants that are going to bloom in May. Maine, it would be from right now, April, right through the end of October. Because we have a lot of species of native bees that use those plants, and they're not all around all summer long. So you want to have plants that are available for the early season bees and the mid-season bees and the late season bees. That's the challenge. Sometimes it takes a little bit more property than each one of us has, but it's what we're going for.
Jude, thanks for your call. Doug, I want to ask you about an area that many people have in their property, especially here in Maine. There are a lot of people who have property that borders woodland. And I know that you believe that space between the lawn and the woodland, is a really special place and a place that can be very beautiful and also very helpful. And tell me how you would like people to think about that space.
That's an edge habitat. It's called an ecotone. It typically gets more sunlight than actually is available in the woods. Plants love sunlight, so it's a very valuable and ecologically rich place. What you want to do is think about plants that will transition from the woods down to your yard. And that would really be your shrubs. So your native viburnums would be a wonderful plant for that space. I don't know if bottlebrush buckeye probably doesn't occur up in Maine, but that would be another good one. So things that need sun to bloom and often turn into berries later on. Certainly your high bush blueberries would be wonderful there. And those berries are going to, particularly your viburnum berries, they're very high in fat and they're very important for migrating birds. Because they need the fat to fuel that migration. The overwintering birds need the fat to get through the winter as well. From landscape design perspective, you want a slope from your canopy trees right down to your yard, and it takes understory trees and shrubs to create that slope.
All right, an email here from Dewey. Interesting question on April 22nd. What are Mr. Tallamy's views of the practice of no-mow May, i.e. not mowing one's grass during the month of May to nurture the ecosystem?
It's a wonderful idea, but it makes no ecological sense. And that goes back to what I was just saying. The pollinators that require those blooming plants need them for more than the month of May. So if you don't mow your yard, first of all, if you have a yard the way you're supposed to, you'll have nothing but tall grass in that yard, and that's not going to help the pollinators at all. If you have a terrible yard with a lot of dandelions and clover and all kinds of things that actually do bloom, they'll bloom in the month of May, but then you'll mow it in June, and all the pollinators that are depending on those flowers will be in trouble because you've just removed their resource. So it is much better to have a no-mow area. That's called your pollinator garden, where you're not going to mow anytime, and have that sequence of blooming plants all season long.
We'll go to Jennifer calling from Falmouth. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Doug. I have a question about goldenrod. So many varieties. And for those of us with meadows, the goldenrod can be kind of a bully. And should I just accept that as one of the keystone species and be happy for it? Or is there a way to keep a variety in the meadow for that biodiversity through the season?
You're probably talking about Canada goldenrod, and it is somewhat of a bully. It's highly competitive, and it will push out other plants. It is a really valuable species of goldenrod. Goldenrod is one of the best plants that we can plant for specialist pollinators. It's also one of the best plants for caterpillars. It supports 110 species of caterpillars. But as you say, there's a number of species of goldenrod, and you can have many of those species without Canada goldenrod that won't outcompete the other plants. So if you have a Canada goldenrod issue and you want to get rid of that and put in some of the other species, that will increase the diversity that you're probably looking for.
All right, Jennifer, thank you so much for calling in. A question from Cassandra on Facebook. Any advice on how to convince town and city governments to landscape with more native plants?
This is happening around the country because it's become an important issue for the citizens that vote for the townspeople. You know, many of these civic positions are, you know, we vote these people in. And if we make it known that these are important issues to us, and if you don't listen to the public, you're not going to be voted in, they will listen. They simply want to have a job. It's hard to change our culture. And in the past, you know, a neat culture where every plant was just a decoration, nature was someplace else, we didn't worry about a biodiversity crisis. That was the past. And a lot of the rules that are on the books are stuck in that past. So we are changing them. Homeowners associations are recognizing that you can use native plants tastefully. It does not reduce property value. But, you know, transition does take time. I have been talking about this for 20 years, and I do see the needle moving, so I'm encouraged. Don't give up.
And all somebody needs to do is look at one of your books and see the beautiful gardens, and they'll be convinced.
Yeah, that will work.
An email here from Scott. I had a wonderful backfield, many wildflowers, etc. My neighbor used to mow it about once a month. We stopped doing that a few years back, and the birches are taking over, plus some other non-native trees. What do you think? I've been cutting them back and sequestering them to small areas to let the grasses and flowers grow.
Yeah, in the east, a meadow is not going to stay a meadow. We get enough rain that woody plants will come in. It used to be disturbance from large mammals. We had large Pleistocene mammals here not that long ago that kept things open. So if you don't apply regular disturbance, you will lose the meadow. It's the hardest thing, the hardest little ecotype to maintain. As you move further west and you have less rain, then prairies are easier to maintain. But yeah, if you want a meadow in the east, you're going to have to keep the woodies out.
We'll go to Joan calling from Ogunquit. Hi, Joan. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer, and I wanted to say hi to Doug. I just wanted to mention that we are looking forward to having Doug come, and he'll be talking on June 23rd at the Ogunquit Playhouse, and it's free and open to everybody. So we have a ton of people that are just thrilled and waiting to hear him. It's going to be a great evening.
There we go. So people in Southern Maine, you can see Doug Tallamy in person. Also, so many people, Doug, so many organizations emailing in Native Gardens of Blue Hill and some others about their native plant sales. We heard from Audubon, but chances are there is a native plant sale near you. And Doug, what do you think about people sharing native plants? Is that a good idea or not so much because you don't know what's in somebody's property?
Oh, I think generally it's a good idea. Native plants do reproduce, and a lot of people end up with runners that they can pot up, or with seeds. The demand for native plants exceeds the supply right now. So if you have a favorite native garden down the street and they're willing to share some of it, it's a great source of native plants.
Well, thank you so much. What a treat to have Doug Tallamy here on Earth Day. Doug Tallamy's organization's is Homegrown National Parks. He has written influential books about saving nature. He's a professor of entomology and wildlife ecology at the University of Delaware. Today's sound engineer, Sam Tracy, Maine Calling produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Colin Woodard and the question, what ideals do Americans share? I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.